Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show on BBSRadio.com and Tantalk1340.com and 1340 AM and 1400 AM in Tampa Bay. And the rest of you guys in every single country in 104 countries around the world. Tonight's guest is Bob Hoover. Now, Bob, I met not too long ago, and he's got a big background in music. He's done some exciting projects. He and I are working on this levitation project using Pleiadian sound. His speaker systems are some of the best in the world. He's just an amazing guy. He designed synthesizers with the big boys years ago, which I now use. So without any further hesitation, hi, Bob, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fine tonight. I'm always doing fine every night.
Excellent.
Anyway, so how's the weather up there? You got any rain going on?
No, it's spectacular, actually. We've had almost a week now of just absolutely gorgeous weather.
Yeah,
it was in the 80s today.
Oh, that's good. Would you like to have it that way all summer, or do you want some rain?
It was that way all summer last year. We loved it. We just absolutely loved it. So
we had rain in the winter.
It was intense, yeah, November in particular, between the snow and the rain. We had, I think it was 2 feet of rain in a matter of, I don't know, a week or something, 3 days.
Yeah.
That was interesting. A foot and a half of snow, that never happens around here. So.
Yeah, you're playing around with weather control, right? You just haven't learned how to mask yet.
Well, we got the summer figured out. So.
Yeah, you got that figured out. If you get the winter figured out, I'll move up there. There's more room up there. I'm down here doing a little vertical. So anyway, all you listeners out there, as we go along, we'll do the live chat at BBS Fast Chat tonight, like we always do. So, Bob, you have a very fascinating background. And, you know, being a musician myself of sorts, more of a scientist, but I try, give us a little of your background. It's fascinating, you know. I mean, it's just how you started into this business, you know.
Well, I started actually by playing music when I was a kid, and played quite a number of instruments, but not really very, you know, professionally. Proficiently.
You're kind of a volume player like me. You played a little of everything.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And in my high school years, I did a lot of work playing with audio equipment, hi-fis, things like that, and when I started looking around going to universities, I found the university I went to, it's UC Santa Cruz. They had just started an electronic music studio, and this I heard switched on Bach while I was there, and their studio had one of those synthesizers, and that just basically got me started.
Which synthesizer were you using back at that studio?
It's a Moog modular. It wasn't a large one, but it was the same one that they did switched on Bach with. And the instruments and how they were used, the voicing, you know, this, you know, 300-400-year-old music, and it was just totally alive using these voices, which didn't exist when the music was invented.
Right.
And that voicing, I think, is what really caught me, is that these instruments are as expressive or more expressive than the mechanical ones.
Yeah.
And so that's how I got started, and I built a lot of equipment. I was the technical director for the studio there for all the years I was there. I did all the recordings on campus the last few years I was there, and I built probably the first computer-based recording studio. It was done with as pre-MIDI, pre all that, but I used the computer to record the performance and play it back through the synthesizer. And
did you have to design all the in and out A to D converters and circuitry to get in and out of the computer too, all that stuff?
Right, and I didn't make my own computer, but I had to fix my own computer. There was a broken computer there, so I fixed. This is back
when they were like 30 the speed or something like that.
No,
really
it wasn't
slow.
One of those. It was actually a mini computer, it had less computing power than an Apple II, but it was, you know, a 6 foot high rack, that type of thing. But
yeah, I remember at the University of Michigan when I worked in the cyclotron, the synchrotron back in the early '50s. We had computers. We had 6SN7 triodes for flip-flops.
Right, right.
Remember those?
I don't know if you know the Burroughs 220.
Yeah, I do.
That filled the whole room.
Burroughs was one of my clients where they made those, yeah.
Yeah, those are amazing computers. Even today, how they were built, how elegant they were, just amazing. But they were all tubes, and 50,000 tubes.
And yeah, the racks of them.
The whole room, and the air conditioning was a whole other building.
that's what we had, too. But I mean, to interrupt, I just had to throw that in, because I know you've been around my time, too, you know, which is kind of neat.
Right, yeah. And the one of the things that most people don't realize is when you have 50,000 tubes, and the tubes have an average life of 30,000 hours, a tube is going out, you know, like every 20 minutes. So think of having your computer crash because the tube died every 20 minutes. It's sort of a different concept from what most people relate to these days.
Like programs like COBOL and Fortran, or
Yeah, there's some early Fortran on it, but these machines were not. I'm sort of digressing here, but these machines were not fixed width machines. A lot of them, so they didn't run traditional languages quite the way we have them now. So the machine, that particular machine, I think was variable width, and it went by. I think it was 8-bit nibbles or something, 4 8-bit nibbles, and so you could go up to 40-bit words, and they didn't really have languages. It was all hand-coded back then, and so you just sit down and figure out what you want the computer to do, and then you get write each instruction, and, you know, the program might have 500 instructions in it. Now a program would have 5 million, but back then it'd have 500.
Yeah. So go ahead. So anyhow, you started hooking up the computer to the synthesizers. And
right, and so I did probably the first looping program where you'd lay down your bass rhythm track, you might say, your bass track, which was the tune, and then it would allow you to record track after track on top of that using the computer as the memory for the tracks. And so that system, and it looped, it started the thing over and over again, so you could just sit and listen to it and play over it and play over it and improvise.
What were you using for memory, those tapes? Those old CDC tape machines,
paper tape. Paper tape.
Yeah.
And
okay.
I had really hot equipment. I could read 100 characters per second on my thing. So, considering the 10 characters.
Just a little faster than the teletype machine.
Yeah, it punched out. Well, I actually had it punching out on a fast punch. Eventually, I started with teletype, but teletypes are 10 characters per second. So that's like. Even when you're talking about a 300 instruction program, it takes a long time. So
bringing all this up, because from where you started, where we are today, is a big, big jump. You know,
right? And it's sort of the one of the things that I really am quite fond of is this thing called Moore's Law, which is back in the 70s, which is about this time. Can't remember his name. He started Intel. I think it's Charles Moore, something like that. And he did a study, and he realized that over the last 10 years of technology, he was looking back at the time, he realized that technology, every 18 months, technology doubled in sophistication. That means that every year and a half, it either costs half as much for the same thing or you get twice as much for the same price. And it has been doing that now for 40 years. And so you can look at it that it's an exponential curve, which is the interesting part of it, is that it's not 40 years you get, 80 times more. Every year and a half, it doubles. And so it's an exponential curve. And so much of my work in the last many years, but I'd say in the last 10, 15 years, has been projecting what happens 10, 20 years from now. With technology doubling every 18 months, so when I was working at Interval, this research lab, Paul Allen's research lab, that was our job, was to say, okay, what is the technology going to look like in 10 years, and can we build it now, even though it might be very expensive now? Everybody will have it in their home in 10 years, but we got to pick the right directions, and so that was our job, was to say, what can you do with the technology?
So were you working with Paul Allen? That was one of your last things before you went out on your own, right?
Yeah, it was the last, it was my last sort of formal employment, I guess you'd say. I did a lot of consulting after that, but it was a real 9-to-5 job, not the consulting. I did many years of consulting and starting my own companies before that. And when I was working at the research lab, it was very much a standard job. And then the project I was working on turned into its own company, and that was very standard. And then after that, I went back into consulting and then started my own company.
That's the one you have now?
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Tell everybody about the synthesizers that you designed and built and back in the name of that company that you had back then, you know?
Right. Well, I actually was starting my own synthesizer company. After I was done, I spent some time back east at a conservatory, Oberlin Conservatory, and I ran the electronic music studio there, the technology part of it. And in my spare time, I was working on new ideas for digital synthesizers. Digital synthesizers were very, very new back then.
Yeah.
And so I came up with
like
a structure
in the
mid-80s? For it.
Yeah.
Very late 70s, really.
So I
invented an architecture, and I was starting a company to do this, and I ended up getting hired by another company to do another project. And while I was at that company, I was talking with a friend of mine, and he was going to design a new music synthesizer a music synthesizer. They're very rare back then. But a music synthesizer for the Apple computer, and he told me about the design he was working on, which is basically the sounds you get in the Pac-Man game. It was very, very simple.
Right.
And I said, you know, you could do something that would last, 10 years. You could have a product that would really go for a long time, and you might want it to look like this. And I explained how it could all go together. And that became the Mountain Music Card, which was wasn't terribly expensive. It was like $300 for the 16-voice digital music synthesizer that plugged into an Apple II computer. And a company called Centauri Corporation wrote a piece of software that turned it into an interactive live instrument. And so it had a keyboard, and it had scoring and a multi-track recording system and a whole orchestra, many more instruments, but hundreds of instruments that would load into the synthesizer. And so that process, that project, ended up being literally the first publicly, commercially available, I guess would be the right way to say it, commercially available digital synthesizer, and certainly computer-based digital synthesizer.
What company was it under, anyway?
Well, Mountain Computer made the synthesizer, and then Centauri Corporation made the software that worked with the synthesizer. And I worked for Centauri for a number of years and actually did an advanced version of that synthesizer, but it never came out because, well, the Apple II market changed, a lot of things changed in that time. But anyway, the synthesizer architecture is very, very similar to pretty much everything that's done nowadays, because it's the best way to do it as far as I'm concerned. And it's had a fair amount of longevity, which is good. The biggest shift from that type of synthesis, which is what's called wavetable synthesis, was when Chowning came out with his FM synthesis.
I remember what unit was that? I remember the FM synthesizers. Well, there was a pile of buttons across the front of them, square buttons. I forget what company made those things.
Yamaha had the patent. The DX1 was the very first of those. They had, they've been making FM synthesizers ever since. And it's everything.
So there was a company out in the Bay Area that made them too, wasn't there? Or not?
No, Yamaha had an exclusive thing. And actually, the Roland, strangely enough, the Roland D50 was their big shot at competing with it.
Linear arithmetic, this is what we use, yeah.
Right, and it does a limited form of FM, but it's not the same FM as Chowning's because their patents would, get in the way. So they built the linear arithmetic in their version of FM specifically to compete with the Yamaha series. So that whole, the D50 and that whole range of instruments was the first of that genre, and that, you know, tried to take an analog synthesizer and a digital synthesizer and really merge the two. And then the physical modeling is the other big form of synthesis that's happened, where you actually have essentially a software program simulating the air traveling down the instrument. It actually builds a computer model for what's going on in the instrument. And that type of an instrument is very, very powerful. It's very complex. It sounds just like the, you know, what you're modeling, but it's very, very hard to control because there's so many parameters. But
yeah,
the physical modeling stuff is now pretty standard also.
That's
but
what
the original,
you've been trying to get me into, I think, a little bit, right?
Not so much. There's derivatives. When you get into digital, direct digital synthesis of any format, because they have software which models the D50, they have software that models, you know, all the FM synthesizers, and they even have software that doesn't 2600 and ARP 2600. We were talking about that yesterday.
Yeah.
And you have all the same knobs, all the same switches, all the same controls as on the original synthesizer, but it's just a piece of software pretending. And
yeah,
so it's a lot less expensive to buy 10 of those instruments than to fill your room up with 10 mechanical ones, you know, 10 standard ones. And
yeah, the reason that, I'll explain to the audience what we're talking about. The reason that we're talking about modeling in that is because in down here we took Pleiadian sounds and we created, mixed them with an old Atari in a computer, which I still have, and a D50 command program, and we came up with these Pleiadian sounds. And then accidentally playing around with the Pleiadian sounds, we've actually been able to levitate objects. So Bob and I are going to be, and a couple others, Randy Masters, we're all working on getting some, you know, levitation things going here again, which this planet definitely needs through sound. Remember to talk about the Pleiadian spaceships are sound-powered and light-separated. So if we start powering, you know, any gravity, then we can probably somehow separate light out of sound. It's going backwards is on the scale, but on frequency. But I think that, you know, that's the way they do it. I think we'll finally come up with a technology and possibly the computer thing that you're working on, the new advanced stuff. Is we may make some headway there, you know. So I just want to explain that to the audience. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah.
No, that's right. The type of versatility that computer synthesis has, basically, there's no limits. It's whatever you can imagine. It's a little bit like they have with motion pictures now, is that they aren't limited by what they can build with a physical set. They aren't limited by what a person can do physically. And it's very convincing. You know, you watch a major motion picture, you're pretty much convinced people are doing what they're doing on screen, and it's all basically done using computers to build a world that doesn't really exist. And I'm talking about doing something similar with in the audio world, that you can build instruments, you can build sounds that don't exist in the physical realm, and you might get results that you wouldn't get just, you know, banging cymbals together, playing some strings or something. So this, and Channing's FM was a really good example of that. Is really based on some just fundamental mathematics, and the sounds had never been heard. They sounded like gongs, but they really weren't gongs. And it opened up a whole new type, a whole genre of instrument, which had a whole sound, but it never existed before because it was all mathematical. So there's a lot of that type of possibility when you have computers driving things. So I tend to, you know, go for the possibilities. Going to have a lot of flexibility. So that would be the reason that I would go more towards computers. Just
yeah,
to have that.
I want to let everybody know you're going to be you'll be at my seminar, and you'll be talking about a lot of this music stuff and sound healing. That's part of it. One day we just, Bob and I met at the Sound Healing Conference about 3 weeks ago on was May 11th, 12th, up there in San Francisco. And the whole auspices of that was sound healing.
Right,
and
right.
And then I played some D50s meditation music, and then one of my songs that played all over Germany and introduced the sound. People have been kind of excited over it. You got to bring your D50, mm-hmm. the rack mount down, right, to capture the sounds out of these
right.
cars
mm-hmm.
I've got down here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That'll be fun.
We'll bring it on the airplane. Have a
yeah, it doesn't take up much space. And you know, it's really funny. One of the other engineers from the was in New York called Mikhail yesterday. It was
mm-hmm.
yesterday. It was Friday. It was business day, and he said, "Hey, tell Dr. Fred quit bidding on this 550 on eBay. I want to do some Pleiadian sounds." I said, "Okay."
That's
so fun. I stopped my bidding, and I think hopefully he won it. If he's listening to that, I hope you won the darn thing.
Well, there's
a group out there that wants to play around now. We've got a play group here, you know.
Well, I was looking on eBay.
Huh?
I was looking on eBay for 550s also, and I was watching things go by, and it's like, oh, okay. And then I called up a friend of mine who literally wrote the book on the D50. He's a writer, and I said, "Do you happen to have one?" And he said, "Yeah, and I think I'm selling it." So I didn't steal anything from eBay from you. You got
oh, good. They're on there all the time. About once a week, another one, and they sell around the mid threes is where they go. I bought
right.
one last $389, and
mm-hmm.
then I've got
mm-hmm.
other ones here. I want to stack them because that's what I'm used to doing until I learn a different way. But
sure.
They go in mid threes. You got a good deal on yours, I think. You paid less than that, right?
Yeah, I got a 550, so it's not
a 550, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, they're not
as expensive. Yeah, that D550 is a rack mount. That's what I'm talking about. They're selling in the mid-threes. The keyboard
mm-hmm.
is going a little bit more. They're like $450, $500.
$450, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah,
they're $100.
Yeah.
But I don't need any more of those. I got a stack of those already, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Have too much
yeah,
room. Yeah.
Right, yeah, that's what I'm saying is that in my world on a laptop, the modern laptops can hold, you know, the equivalent of 50 of those synthesizers, so.
Yeah, but you know, when you, you've got 50 of them, you've got all these audio outputs. The computer's only going to have, you know, one set of audio outputs, right? So they're all going to have to be.
Not necessarily. No, not at all.
So what do you have, many outputs? You have a box that goes on the computer that gives many outputs?
Right. FireWire is typically the best way to do that. But they have, off of laptops, you can get 30 and 60 outputs.
So you have to have some kind of a box to plug it into. I mean, obviously.
Right, right. The computer doesn't do it. It's a box that just tells the computer.
That's what I meant, like an interface.
Right, right. Yeah, there's quite a number of them now. Most of the digital studios can all be done on laptops.
Yeah.
Modern laptops are pretty powerful. And all the box that sits external, that has all the connectors on it, things like that, and it does the part that you don't build into the laptop, and then the laptop gets the data over FireWire.
Well, once you get these programs, now you've already done some analysis on one of these Pleiadian sounds, the one
right.
I call distant, right? I think
mm-hmm.
did you get it from the concert, or where did you get the sound from? I don't
know. No,
it's
on the disc. It was on the disc that comes with
your book. Oh, the disc I sent, yeah, off the book. Yeah, that's right. I forgot.
Mm-hmm.
When we sell our book, Rays of Truth, we give you a free sound disc with it on CD. And you
right.
got it there, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you find in that sound anyway? Anything interesting?
It was quite harmonic, especially it was tied in with the fourth harmonic quite a bit. There are two waveforms, one of which was called the fundamental waveform, and a second waveform came in on its fourth harmonic. And both waveforms had both even and odd harmonics. The second waveform is a sawtooth. So
right, another one would be a square wave. Yeah,
it was a pulse wave, actually, not quite a square wave, but a pulse wave.
Yeah.
And that gave you, if you do a pulse wave, you get even and odd harmonics also. And
yeah,
so it was the full series of even and odd harmonics with an emphasis
yeah.
on the even harmonics two octaves up from the fundamentals.
Interesting.
And then they were offset in frequency a little bit, so they beat it against each other.
Yeah, so two octaves up, both sets of harmonics, and they kind of an interesting
right.
thing, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly,
You don't see a lot of that kind of stuff around too often, I take it.
Well, one of the things that's really interesting about it and how you've used it, I've heard you in concert, obviously, and a bit on the disc.
Yeah.
You use it in a chorus, what I call a chorusing effect, which is that you build a whole series of instruments which are all playing sort of the same notes or harmonics of the same notes, but none of them are tuned exactly on. It builds a very
right.
rich sound. And
right.
so So you end up with something that's I don't know if you'll like this or not, but it's semi-reminiscent of a huge pipe organ.
Yeah, no, I think that's cool. I'll tell you why.
It's a huge sound.
Yeah, yeah, it is. That's why we were talking about speak. I know that one of the masters in the White Brotherhood, who lives in a cave for many, many, many years in the Himalayas, a couple of the Himalayan masters in the Brotherhood, they have organs in their caves. You know, where they hide away. The organ seems to be the instrument of choice for these kind of guys. You know, and I guess it's kind of in my
book. One of the things I found that's quite interesting that I guess audio people have known this for a long time, and I've known it for a long time, but it's quite surreal how real the effect is. But if you have playback equipment and playing back a recorded organ, I have some really phenomenal organ recordings. And
right.
If you have playback equipment that's okay, the organ sounds okay.
Right.
And if you get better and better quality playback equipment, the organ gets more and more energy, and it becomes more and more alive. And the more you remove the veils of the playback technology, the more alive the recording is, you know, the more alive the sound coming from it is. And eventually what you get is, of course, the experience of being there, that organs are quite difficult to reproduce correctly. And you really have to get rid of all the, what I call the crud, all the distortions, and all the interactive and intermodulations and everything. If you get rid of all that, it ends up having a very, very powerful sound. And so I think a little bit of what you're working on has that same character.
Yeah, I didn't know, you know, most of my stuff that I've invented, half of my things I've invented in my life have been quite by accident.
Well, yeah, but it's a gut feel. You have an,
yeah, exactly.
You have an intuitive feel for it, yeah.
Yeah, because I remember whenever I see a commercial, you know, especially years ago, they don't use it so much. I'd say, oh, there's an M1 sound or there's this, you know, there's a D50, and I even knew the sound because on the commercials and on the sound effect, I got at one point in my life, I just about recognized, oh, there's an ARP 2600, oh, there's a Memory Moog. I mean, I just get to know them all, you know, the Mellotron. But now, now the sounds, I think the sounds are flatlined on the TV. I mean, I don't hear those really cool sounds, you know what I mean? It's crappy stuff. It's dumb what's out there again. I think the people the music people out there making commercials got retarded somehow.
Yeah, it is an interesting interesting effect. There's sounds actually that we've become familiar with are much broader in nature than what they were, you know, 30 years ago. 30 years ago, you played a sawtooth wave through a filter, and, you know, you were on another planet.
Yeah.
And nowadays, playing something like that, it's just what comes out of your cell phone. I mean, it's like, you know, hey, somebody's cell phone's ringing.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the wild sounds have integrated into our lives. Just the sounds that your computer makes, you know, are surreal compared to what we had 30 years ago. And that's a really interesting shift that people aren't familiar with, that people's psyche. I use this as an analogy a lot. That if somebody saw a little square box land on their front lawn, and you know, somebody who looked like Kirk and Spock getting out, you know, nobody'd freak out because it's like, oh yeah, I've been there, I've seen it all my life.
Right.
but you know, once upon a time, something like that happened. That would be pretty freaky. And then you know, it's. I don't know if you've ever been to the Star Trek exhibit in Las Vegas. They have a ride there, but they have this restaurant. And when you're sitting in the restaurant, they have actors in costume and in character from Star Trek wandering around the restaurant, talking to people and interacting.
Yeah,
it's a very, very it's a very unique experience. And the Klingon comes up and grabs you by the collar and lifts you up, you know, and gives you a hard time. And they have these little guys walking around, beautiful, excellent makeup and costumes and everything.
Right.
And again, that would be a lot freakier an experience if we hadn't seen these characters on TV all the time.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you, when I used to manage Xenia Seberg, she was the star of Lex on the Sci-Fi Channel. We used to go out. We used to go to all the conventions for autograph signings. We'd arrange these conventions. We'd take her out there, and then some of the cast of Lex.
sure.
And of course, yeah, and these guys, one big floor, one down in Orlando we used to do every year. And I'll tell you, these guys are running around in all these costumes like you're describing, doing crazy things. And then the fans get dressed up, you know, in like that and start doing it. It was a lot of fun. You know, it really was.
But it's something that's assimilated into the culture. There's not the phobia or the distance anymore. It's sort of like there's a compassion that's there. And that's true with the sounds, that these sounds that were very surreal once upon a time now have just blended in along with violins and everything else. And if you hear a synthesizer along with an orchestra, it doesn't bother anybody now.
I remember the Moody Blues.
I was working
with them when they did that. You know, they had the Boston. They had one in London, the London Orchestra at first.
London Philharmonic, right?
Yeah, the London Philharmonic. Yeah, it was years ago. Justin was brilliant. Justin Hayward, he was behind that, and Mike Pinder.
But that was the establishment. That was the time where the boundaries between the world started to go away. And now it's pretty hard to know what is what anymore. It's really sound textures. But the other thing that's interesting is that the instruments, some of the most powerful instruments that I know of, are actual mechanical ones that have been sampled and then modified.
And
it's a very interesting thing. A little bit like what you're doing with Palladian sounds. You sort of get the sound and then start playing with it and see what you can do with it.
Yeah, we set it up in an energy chamber in our living room, and then we have an area where people have Stargate experiences. They actually go out onto ships, you know. There's even a thing on YouTube. If you type my name in, Dr. Fred Bell, Martin Sargent came down here with a film crew working on this. He went through it. I mean, and he was not on drugs or alcohol or anything, and he was freaked out. I mean, he had the experience. Mm-hmm. He went out for about 15 minutes.
That's fun.
You're going to do it when you come down here next weekend. We're going to let you try it. How's that?
I'm ready. We have our version of Stargates here, but might not be quite set up like yours.
Speaking of that, you know, the conveyance of the sound, you know, you're into these electrostatic speakers. I know that's what you design and build now, right? Could you tell the audience a little bit about that technology? I know it's a little pricey, but some of them out there might want them if you got room to sell, you know.
Of course.
Yeah.
It's actually a concept. It's not to make expensive speakers. It's to make the concept, and right now they're just very hard to do it.
Yeah.
What's happened, and this is sort of following our little history here, back in the 50s, they had tube equipment and did recordings of tube equipment, tape recorders. And then went to electronics and vinyl, where they recorded to tape and into vinyl. And then in the mid-70s, I guess, they came up with the concept of the CD. And late 70s, it was starting to be established. And they made a whole bunch of design decisions when they came up with the CD format that were based around the technology of the day. Now, remember Moore's Law, that, you know, every year and a half, the technology gets half as expensive.
Right.
And so what was very expensive to do then is trivial now. You know, everybody's cell phone has better fidelity than, you know, what most people have.
Well, I had cell phones. Remember the cell phones we used to carry around looked like walkie-talkies? Remember those?
Yeah, literally. Yeah, I had one of those for about 10 years. That's very early cell phones.
Yeah, they were expensive, too, like $1,200, $1,500, I think, I paid for one of those ones.
Right, but they had the range, so that made them worth it.
Yeah, they were good. They cut out like these new ones.
So the CD got established mainly by having to have a disc that's 5 inches in diameter, has to go longer than an hour, and had to be done with an infrared laser. And that basically said, okay, the sample rate has to be 44,000 samples per second, 16 bits, which means 65,000 levels to the audio. This is just the standard technology that's out there. So every CD runs on that format. It's called Redbook for all the techies out there. They know, already know that, I bet. But the Redbook format for CD has some problems with it. What they did was they pushed everything to the limit on the technology, but they cut back in areas that have turned out to be quite essential to human happiness. In other words, if you record something to CD and play it back, the body actually reacts to it, responds to it somewhat negatively, creates stress. And this was demonstrated in the 80s by a guy by the name of John Diamond. He did a talk in front of all these at the AES show. All these audio engineers were there, and he stood up in front of the audience and muscle tested a guy playing back the original recording and a CD version of the recording. And the CD recording failed the muscle test. In other words, the person lost their strength.
Their energy, yeah. And what was the other one? They were just using normal Scotch
just
tape like we used to?
Right,
yeah.
Just analog tape.
And
And so this was to try to, he's a sound healer. He plays back music, and he would play back a digitally recorded version of exactly the same performance, and people would not relax. He uses music to relax people to help in the healing process, and people would not relax with the digital recordings.
Very interesting.
So he did this talk in front of all these audio engineers and pleading with them, don't decide on the CD standard, don't decide on the CD standard, but it's sort of too late. And so
what was the vibrate? Were they like, is this the 44 megahertz, or was this from the
28?
Some of those, huh?
It's 44 kilohertz.
34K kilohertz. That's what it was in those days. Okay, I just wondered. Yeah,
it still is. You buy a CD, it's the same exact thing.
Same thing. Okay.
And so anyway, this has been a dilemma in my world, which is really refined audio. This is a dilemma because you can go back to the old vinyl records and they sound better than the CD.
Well, yeah, I played my old 45s still. I've got on an old record. I just love the sound of those things.
Right.
Scratches and all, it doesn't matter. Yeah.
And they have a lot of distortion, but the distortion doesn't bother you the same way.
No,
that these,
I love them. I like to sit down with a glass of wine and play records of that from my collection from 40 years back, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I play them on an old Philco player, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So my world is the CD was sort of a step backwards. It was a little frustrating. And about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I heard a CD player that didn't have the problem. It took the original discs, but it did not have the digital hardness, the harshness that has been synonymous with CDs. And I said, oh, my God, it's now time to be able to build. The digital has gotten to the point that it's now time that you can build equipment that does not have the limits of the tape or disc or CD.
Right.
And sort of at the same time, two new recording formats came out, which are popular, relatively popular. They're not like CDs are, but they're relatively popular. One's called SACD, which Sony and Philips did. Called Super Audio CD, and the other one is DVD audio, that the actual audio tracks on your DVD have hundreds of times more resolution than a CD has. And this means that when you play back your film, you get a sound, the sound impact from the film is dramatically better and does not necessarily have the harshness, if you have good equipment, does not have the harshness of a CD. And so now there's these new recording formats, and those new recording formats are allowing people to have in their homes the same sound that comes out of the recording, the mixing console. It's not vinyl, it's not CD, it is the sound that went to the mastering recorder.
Right.
And this is a very, very big change in the world of high fidelity audio, I guess you'd call it.
Oh, yeah, no, for those of you that are out there, I've worked with many, many great studio engineers, and when you're in there and they're mixing an album, it's way different than when you hear it on the street at the record store when you go buy it 6 months later.
Right.
It's a different
animal. And what happens...
You're in the sound in the studio. You're in it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's actually the comment that happens. I play back these recordings, which have been very carefully done. And they're commercial recordings, but they're very well recorded. And people sit and listen to it on my system, and it sort of blows their mind because they've never heard anything like that. They've never heard the clarity as you described, the sound goes through you. That's literally what happens. It's not this thing making noise. It's actually
the sound. True hologram generator.
Right. It envelops you. And that's where things start getting interesting to me, because now the sound becomes you, and now what can you do with that? And it doesn't bother you. You don't have any of the weaknesses. There's none of the short changing. And so the reason I'm doing these speakers is saying, okay, how far can I go with this new recording technology? And what happens when you have these recordings and you play them back for people? And I've had people go into tears. I've had people be in a state of shock. Randy Masters had some really interesting comments. He says it's better than being on stage with the musicians. You can actually hear what's going on better than if you're actually in the midst of the musicians, which is the best position.
Yeah.
And the focus and the clarity come from the recording techniques, which basically remove the extraneous sound and get the focus of the instruments through the recording. And that's not what you get in a hall. You get the hall and all the distractions.
Now, with your stuff, what happens if you put a normal CD on it? Will it sound a lot better? Will you muscle test any better?
Yeah.
You will.
Yeah, well, there are tricks now. This equipment that I was telling you about is actually made by Wadia Corporation. It's very expensive stuff. And
this
what
is
they
the
did.
The playing equipment? The players?
The one that I use is a transport and converters. They're two separate things, but the magic is really in the converters. And
okay.
What
price range are these things anyway?
Converters. The low end system is about $6,000-$8,000. It's just for a CD player. The one I use is $20,000.
Yeah.
The transport's $10,000 and the converter's $10,000.
So you're going to spend about $25,000-$30,000. Before I get to your speakers.
Right. Well, I don't even use that equipment on my speakers. I had to do my own.
Build your own.
I build everything, because that was very nice for CDs, but it didn't work for these other formats.
Right.
And so I've had to literally start over, because the new formats are so much more powerful than the CD format. But that demonstrated, the Wadia equipment demonstrated what could be done with CDs. If you have a large CD collection, I highly recommend getting even the less expensive Wadia equipment, because it's just musically just so much better than any other CD player.
But what about with conventional speakers? It still helps through
those? Yeah, the problem that I have is that my speakers are incredibly revealing. If there's a problem, anybody can hear it. It doesn't take a rocket scientist or some golden ear person. I have people come in and I'll play a CD on it, and they know. I play the high resolution recordings, and we go from one recording to the next, and you say there's something wrong with the electronics, and they can actually tell that it's a microphone preamp that's not biased correctly, or it's a cable that's bad. That's how revealing it is.
What happens if you take an old 45 RPM slightly used record from the 50s and play it on there? How's that going to sound?
It'll be perfectly
hear
etched. It'll be perfectly etched. You will hear all the good parts and all the bad parts. It doesn't really hide things.
Yeah, it's a big contrast. You'll hear a lot more contrast than you normally do.
Yeah, the thing that most people don't know is that those records have a lot of distortion to them, mainly because of how the needle just rides along in the groove. But the distortion was tuned so that it was not too unacceptable for listening.
Yeah.
And so people sort of say, oh, yeah, it's just, sounds fine. But after you've heard a really clean recording and you go back to vinyl, then you can hear that really, because you've gotten used to not having it. If you listen to a lot of vinyl, you get used to it.
Yeah.
And so those sorts of distortions will be there. But the other thing about vinyl, which is really quite a lot of fun, is that it doesn't have the digital edge. It wasn't, it doesn't have that compromise that CDs put on the sound. And so it actually will have an intimacy with the sound that you wouldn't get if you just put a CD of that same disc on. So it would sound both better. Some of my favorite recordings, I play them for people. and they're remastered. They're not the original media. They're mastered on, most of them are mastered on SACD. And they went back to the original tapes and the original masters and, that they did for these recordings in the late 50s, early 60s. They remastered it onto SACD, so they didn't master on CD. They mastered it on a media that has 2,000 times more resolution. And I play those recordings back, and I play a modern recording back, and people can't really tell the difference because those early tape recordings were so well done.
Wow.
And very, very carefully done. And the old tube equipment resolved the fidelity quite well, but the old tube equipment isn't good enough to do the new fidelity.
Right.
And so I've basically had to sort of... the technology that's for sale right now wasn't good enough, and so I had to sort of do a whole new approach. So I did the speakers, and then I had to do the electronics too.
What are your speakers? What's the price range of your speakers roughly? I know they're out there.
The speakers, I'm selling it as a complete system because
okay.
The speakers themselves, if you plug in like a normal amplifier, go down to the store, buy yourself a $5,000 amplifier, plug in the speakers, it'll probably sound really poor because these speakers are not, they're what are called electrostatics. And
right.
They essentially short out the high frequencies of the amplifier. And most amplifiers really have a hard time with that. It's sort of like trying to just take your car, push it up against the wall, drive it up to a wall and then floor it and see how well your car does. It doesn't do very well.
Right.
But if you have a Caterpillar tractor, you push it up against the wall, you floor it, the wall doesn't have a chance.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I sort of build the Caterpillar tractor of amplifiers, except it's very, very accurate. And,
what kind of power? You don't need a lot of power with this system, right? I mean, it's so efficient. The power
is not the issue. The issue is how much current, and what's even more important is how much distortion happens when you're putting that current out.
Yeah.
One of my big things is that you can sort of have the amplifier wired to speakers and arc weld, and it doesn't wreck the sound because there's just so much current there. And
right.
It's,
how much current do your systems draw?
It depends what you're playing, but a system would have four amplifiers, and each one of them would be about 800 watts, something like that. So it could be up in a couple thousand watts. If you were playing very, very loud, high-frequency sounds, it would be that.
Yeah.
But most music, it's not. It's just a couple hundred watts.
Yeah, because I know in the conventional way, like in our studio, we have to have... some big amplifiers, kilowatt amplifiers, to get the bass to play through the woofers,
right.
Subwoofers.
Right.
So you eliminated that problem.
No, not necessarily.
You still have to do it.
You need that.
Yeah.
You need that sort of power for the highs too.
Yeah.
So
it's
a little different, but yeah, for doing the bass, you still need a fair amount of power. But the bass is a problem because normally the reason you need the power is not because the speakers are inefficient. That because the rooms are running below cutoff, I don't know if I want to get that technical, but most rooms resonate, 60, 50, 60, 100 hertz, something like that.
Right.
And so if you want something at 20 hertz, you have to actually pressurize the room.
Okay.
And the room is literally a little pressure chamber. And so now you have to apply huge pressures to get the sound up, like at any levels. And
how do you do that? Do you pressurize it with sound itself or what? Like a subwoofer kind of
thing? Absolutely.
You
have these huge motors tied to your subwoofers. The cones have these huge electromagnetic motors. And you pressurize the room with those electromagnetic motors. It takes thousands of watts to do it.
Wow.
So that's one approach. The other approach, which they use in recording studios a lot, is to build what's called a bass trap.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a thing that makes the room look like it's physically, acoustically a lot larger than it is. It's a big absorbing box.
Right.
And when you absorb the low frequencies, then you aren't pressurizing the room anymore. And so a carefully designed room will have the very the back wall will just be, you know, 6 feet of absorbing material, and it works. And so the sounds of the room doesn't sound like it's a little bitty room anymore.
Wow.
So you need that for driving, you know, driving loud low frequencies in general, and then you need it for most rooms in addition to that.
So anyway, what is the price range on your system, the complete
system? The system with the amplifiers and preamp and a transport is $80,000.
Yeah.
And it's a four cabinets. There's two cabinets for the high frequency, two cabinets for the left, two cabinets for the right, and they're 6 foot tall cabinets. So it's a relatively formidable system, and each cabinet weighs about 300 pounds.
Wow.
That's average.
You got 900 pounds of equipment there.
Yeah, probably more than that. But yeah, it's designed for precision. It's not designed for putting on a bookshelf. But the thing that's important is what you get out of it is something that at least I've never heard before, and I've heard a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's exploring a new realm. The way I look at it, new realm for audio.
How big is the speaker section on those cabinets? I mean, there's like a planar speaker, right? It's flat and thin and tall.
No, they're what are called monopoles. Most speakers are monopoles. Electrostatics tend to be what are called dipoles, which is the sound comes out of the back and out of the front. Mine don't have any sound coming out of the back, and they're a monopole. They're very, very carefully designed, carefully controlled monopoles. They're more accurate than any dynamic loudspeaker in terms of what's called
dispersion. Do they look like a speaker? I mean, what do they look like, the actual transducer part?
Well, some speakers look like them. They're basically 14 inches wide, 16 inches deep, and 6 feet tall. Two cabinets like that for the left and two cabinets like that for the right.
Yeah.
And the front has sort of a grill work on it, and that's about it. They don't look like much. The big thing is what, you know, what they sound like.
Yeah, because you got all your amplifiers and everything is inside the cabinet too, right?
Not in this one. They can mount on the back, but the amplifiers are pretty beefy, so they sit alongside right now. There'll be a version that has electronics inside, but the current system is really what it takes to do the job. So it ends up with the amplifiers right now are alongside cabinets. The base amplifiers in the cabinet.
Yeah, so you're selling a lot of these. I know you were telling me the other day you had quite a few orders, and you're going to be busy for a while.
they're hand-built. One of the things
is
that there's nothing about them that's fast. So, and I have people that have, as I mentioned to you, I have people that have been looking at these things for years waiting for them to be available. And so we're just finishing setting up the production. I've been very low profile on this, mainly because I needed the time to get the work done. And so now that I'm getting closer and we're getting the production going, I'm talking about them more.
Yeah, well, that's good. You're gonna have a website eventually?
Well, there is a website. It says nothing right now. The company's called Superlative Audio. There's a website, www.superlativeaudio.com, but it says basically nothing. Gives a link to info@superlativeaudio.com, so if people want information or want to be put on the mailing list, they can use that. So,
do you have a phone number where people can call yet or anything like that or not?
No, right now I'm just doing it all by email. So
okay.
People can.
What's your email address so people know that?
Well, my email address is bob@superlativeaudio.com.
Well, that's pretty simple.
Yeah.
Yeah, people can always reach you through me because we'll probably be hanging out here and there, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yep.
We'll have some fun. We'll have superlative levitation products pretty soon.
That's it.
That would be kind of neat, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, that definitely can be tuned to do that type of thing.
I'm looking for. I just wish you could. I didn't realize they were that big the other day when I spoke to you about when you come to this. I told Bob. I said, bring some of those puppies down. We'll set them up and we'll play. And he started laughing. You know.
I bought a van. Yeah. No, I literally bought a truck to do it. I mean, it's not a small truck either.
It's not a little Toyota pickup truck.
No, not at all.
We only got a few minutes. What's the future? We got a couple minutes, then we got to go. What's the future look like in your life for your inventions? You got any other things that you're coming up with?
Well, the first thing, yeah, the audio stuff is quite interesting. One of the reasons I was at the Sound Healing Conference is because of this thing I was talking about with CDs, is that I found out that you can build acoustical energy fields that affect people quite a bit more than what people expect from a CD with really
right.
clean recordings. And so one of the things I'm working on is to get healers to start using these new advanced recording formats for doing healing work. And if they use them on my system, well, that would be even better. But just using them in general, I think, is pretty important. And
yeah, well,
so
I look forward to, you know, I want to create more holographic sounds in the near future for a lot of the stuff
right.
that we make, all our projectors and receptors and,
right.
and all of that.
These are
yeah.
laboratory equipment. These have a very, very high degree of precision. And
yeah.
so that's why that, you know, if you want something, you just dial it in and it gives it to you. So that type of thing. Also, it doesn't have any sound of its own, which most people characterize speakers and things by having a sound of their own. These really don't. They sort of go away. And that's a pretty interesting thing for when you're doing something, all of a sudden it doesn't sound like anything. It's just the
yeah.
sound.
Yeah.
So,
okay, well, we're running out of time,
right.
so once again, give out your website and your email,
okay.
and then we got to go.
www.superlativeaudio, SUPERLATIVE, audio.com. And email is Bob at Superlative Audio, or if you want information on the mailing list, it's info@superlativeaudio.com.
Yeah, so anyhow, we had our guest tonight. Thanks, Bob, for being on.
Mm-hmm.
Our guest tonight was Bob Hoover, who lives up in Washington. I met him in San Francisco. We look forward to working with him at Paradyne on some of our advanced music projects. He certainly is more than qualified. He's like a walking legend. And he'll be at the seminar next weekend. This is the last live show for 2 weeks that I'm doing. We'll have a pre-recorded. I'll do a nice show for next Saturday night, but it won't be me live. It'll be a nice spontaneous show. So with that, we got to go. Thank you for listening to one of the hottest shows on BBS Network and the Internet, Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science and Energy Show on BBSRadio.com and Tantalk1340.com in Florida. Have a great, great evening, and we look forward to seeing a lot of you live next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Until then, mahalo and good night.